Today, tensions heighten between Pakistan and India after Kashmir was stripped of its special status. And trouble in Zimbabwe, where Robert Mugabe may be long gone, but his ruling ZANU-PF party is still in charge. Guardian writer Azhar Farooq was in his office in Srinagar when last Monday the Indian government suddenly stripped Jammu and Kashmir of its autonomy after more than seven decades.
When the announcement was actually made, the Kashmir Valley was already deserted. There was completely ghostly silence in the region. There was no traffic outside, no shops were open, no markets were open.
But perhaps most oppressive was the way that all communications were turned off.
The phones had stopped ringing several hours earlier. First, it was the phones which fell dead, then the internet which fell dead, and then the landline phones also. And the other thing that the administration did was it suspended the cable TV news. It effectively made Kashmir an information black hole.
With no access to news, rumours began to swirl. For journalists like Azhar, the challenge was getting information out.
In such a scenario, it was near impossible to send reports out. People were sending their reports in pen drives, asking strangers at airports to deliver them at their offices in New Delhi or other places.
For 7 days, he watched people struggle to travel, even for medical help, face roadblocks, curfews, and make attempts at protest. Which were met on Friday by tear gas, according to BBC footage. The only way Azhar was able to get snippets of information out was by flying to Delhi before quickly returning to Kashmir.
There is a sense of disbelief, there's a sense of shock at what has happened. Almost everyone I talked to ended his conversations with me with these words that God will have mercy on us. It was less of a statement of faith, but it was a desperate search for hope that whatever the future will be, it will not be as ominous as it seems as of now for the Kashmiris.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the crisis in Kashmir. Azhar Farooq is on his way back to Kashmir after giving us that snapshot of what is happening on the ground. Guardian writer Vidhi Doshi spent several years reporting from India and has been watching this story unfold. She says that the Prime Minister Narendra Modi spelt out his intentions for Kashmir when campaigning for re-election this spring.
In May, Modi wins this landslide election.
After 6 weeks and 600 million votes, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi is celebrating a stunning victory.
He gets 300 seats in Parliament, and it gives his party, the Bharatiya Janata Party, this huge mandate to continue with its Hindu nationalist agenda. And this party has always regarded Kashmir as a headache.
And there were signs that something was underway in Kashmir.
In the run-up to the events of last week, this Hindu pilgrimage that happens every year was cancelled.
Jammu and Kashmir government has issued an advisory to tourists and to yatris stating that in the interest of safety, tourists and yatris must curtail their stay in the valley immediately.
The political leaders in Kashmir were put under house arrest. Communications were kind of shut down.
You're watching this as a reporter. Did you know that something significant was coming?
I didn't know that it would come now. But it has been on the BJP's manifesto for a long time. And so on Monday, the 5th of August, Amit Shah, who is India's Home Minister, stood up in Parliament and proposed the scrapping of Article 370. Article 370 is this long-standing provision in India's constitution that allows Kashmir to have a whole bunch of special protections. It gives Kashmir freedoms to have its own flag, to make its own laws. It protects its land. And so when Amit Shah got up and proposed this, it was immediately very clear that there would be no path for Kashmiris to oppose what he was trying to do.
Why was that clear?
All that really needs to happen once he's proposed it is it needs to be passed by India's parliament, which it has now, and then go through Kashmir's assembly, which it hasn't because Modi disbanded it in June last year.
So just to be clear, Modi's government disbanded the elected assembly in Kashmir, got tourists to leave the state, put people under house arrest, even shutting down their communications, and then took the decision to revoke the special status.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, that is sounding like an authoritarian action.
And that's exactly how many Kashmiris will see it. Modi's the kind of leader who wants to get things done, but is willing to ignore democratic process in order to get those things done.
What was the reaction to the announcement?
Well, it depends on who you were. Across India, there was street parties celebrating this historic move to finally assert control over a bit of India that India has always considered Indian. But the progressive left in India has huge problems with what's been done. And it's not just about what's been done, but it's also about how the BJP has gone about doing it. For the Hindu right, this is something that was a long time coming and that needed to happen. But on the other hand, within Kashmir, there is a huge military presence that prevents anyone leaving their house, and there's no way of knowing who is where. People have described it as a mass house arrest. And in Pakistan, there's huge panic. Pakistan's government, its parliament, is deeply concerned about what India is doing.
We've spoken about Narendra Modi before on Today in Focus, and very much get the sense that he wants to project a kind of strongman image. Is that what he's doing?
Yeah, so Modi kind of, to a lot of Indians, represents this very muscular nationalism. It's not that he wants to be seen as an authoritarian leader, of course not. What he wants to be seen as is the man who can fix India, and that will require some strength and some authority.
And in fact, this isn't the first period of tension in Kashmir since the beginning of the year. That actually began back in February. And on that very day, Modi was very much in the kind of strongman role. What was going on?
Earlier this year, Modi filmed this special episode of Man vs. Wild with Bear Grylls.
An ace adventurer who redefines the rules of survival. Unites with the leader of the world's largest democracy.
Welcome to India.
Bear Grylls, as in the adventure man.
The adventure man Bear Grylls. Modi was on a raft floating down a river somewhere in India with him. The government hasn't actually confirmed this yet, but a bit of detective work by some Indian newspapers have strongly suggested that episode was being shot on the same day that tensions flared up again in Kashmir earlier this year.
What happened?
A armed convoy of Indian security personnel was bombed in Kashmir.
On a tragic day for India, 40 CRPF jawans have been killed in the worst terror attack against security men in Kashmir ever.
40 people died. And that kicked off this huge, very belligerent, very aggressive response from Modi.
Wo Bharat par is tarah ke hamle karke.
This was days before the election was about to happen, and many people have read his aggressiveness and his almost very reckless response to that attack as a election-winning strategy.
And the tough response from Modi, what did he actually do?
Basically, he launched an airstrike.
Now, India says it has conducted air raids in Pakistan-administered Kashmir in a major escalation of tension.
In Pakistan, in this region called Balakot. And it led to a few days of very tense exchange of kind of airstrikes, of very sharp words from both countries. And it brought India and Pakistan to the brink of war.
Almost 24 hours after the Indian Air Force carried out what India calls a non-military preemptive strike on the Jaish-e-Mohammed terror camp in Pakistan's Balakot, Pakistan responded today by attempting to target military installations in India.
And it's not the first time that India and Pakistan have been at the brink of war. India and Pakistan have fought over Kashmir for decades. Let's just go right back to the start and tell me, why did Kashmir have this special status in the first place?
Okay, so to understand why Kashmir is this explosive area, you have to go all the way back to Indian independence and Pakistani independence.
An era has ended, a new epoch begins. A subcontinent larger than the whole of Europe becomes two self-governing dominions within the British Commonwealth of Nations.
1947.
In 1947, yes, the British colonial powers kind of roll back and say there's going to be two countries, one's going to be called India and one's going to be called Pakistan.
Pandit Nehru, Congress leader, is India's Prime Minister. Muhammad Ali Jinnah, Muslim chief, becomes Pakistan's Governor General.
And the negotiation of where exactly one country ended and the other one began was a big, very tense, very long drawn out process. And in the middle of it all was Kashmir, who was led by this king called Maharaja Hari Singh, who was a Hindu, but who was the king of a Muslim-majority region. What Maharaja Hari Singh really wanted is for Kashmir to be independent, but he ended up acceding power to India.
The people of Kashmir celebrate newly won independence. Their rejoicing at the cutting of the Maharaja's oppressive powers is tempered by the realization that Kashmir is the stumbling block to peace between India and Pakistan, who sent no...
India took control of Kashmir, but what Maharaja Hari Singh did do to protect Kashmir was give it the special status.
Article 370.
Article 370. And specifically what Article 370 did was it gave Kashmir a whole bunch of special powers.
So that's the starting point.
Yeah.
And since then, there's been a lot of trouble over Kashmir.
Yeah, so Kashmir has always been a disputed region. Pakistan says that it has a claim over Kashmir. China wants a bit of Kashmir for itself. Within Kashmir, there is a movement for independence from all of these different powers. And there's never really been a democratic process, a fair democratic process to find out exactly what the Kashmiri people want. And that's a part of the problem. But it really kind of came to a head in the 1980s. There was a moment in 1987 when Kashmir had a state election, and the results of that election were widely thought to have been rigged by India.
Winding down the streets of Srinagar, no one can sense that the underside of the city is simmering with hurt and anger. The fury of the militant youths stems from their belief that the Congress National Conference combined came to power by rigging the polls.
And that was really a moment for a lot of Kashmiris to kind of step back and think, you know what, this whole promise of autonomy has always been a farce, and we won out. 1987 was a point at which militancy in Kashmir really started to grow.
A lot of new factors that are threatening to radically change the scene in Kashmir is a new underground militant organization, Hizbi Islami. They are claiming to be Mujahid or Crusaders of Islam.
And for the first time, there were a huge movement of young Kashmiri men, largely, who started thinking of themselves as not a part of India.
For novelist Mirza Wahid, who was a teenager in Kashmir at the time, that year was critical. Mirza lives in London now, but he describes an idyllic childhood in Srinagar.
I grew up by the famous Dal Lake. My ancestral home, my parents' home, is about a 10-12 minute walk from the beautiful lake. That's where I grew up. After school, I would go home, drop my bags, and then I would go to the lake for a swim. We have houseboats on the lake, which are tourist boats. People stay. There's a very ornate, elaborate houseboat, some of them approximating a five-star hotel. I used to go to the cinema. One of them is called Firdaus Cinema. And why I mention the cinema is because in 2 years' time, it was turned into a military camp. It's still a paramilitary camp.
Mirza says the feeling among young people who had participated with fervour in the 1987 election was to feel broken and depressed.
Those very boys who had participated in the elections went across to Pakistan to get arms and training. Because you have to remember, see, that it's a very porous border. So Kashmiri boys crossed over into Pakistan, where Pakistani agencies gave them arms and training. They came back to engage Indian armed forces in battle. It was a mass uprising. I remember hundreds of thousands of people marching down the streets in Kashmir, in the main city, Srinagar, but also in other towns and cities, demanding essentially their right to self-determination to be honored. It was brutal. It took me years and many of my generation to process what had happened, because it was so sudden and it was so massive, it was so colossal. The sudden arrival of a massive, massive military machine. Talk about insurgencies and conflicts. We think of sometimes as, you know, these soldiers in the mountains or guerrillas in the mountains or somewhere away from it. It was in the city. It was everywhere. It was outside our house. It was in all these towns and villages. It was brutal. Early 90s, there were thousands of militants. These were Kashmiris who had become militants. It war against Indian army. In army, Indian state rushed in troops, so it came down heavily on the militancy, you know, to crush it. But inevitably, as it happens in such scenarios, they also came down on the population of Kashmir. So as a result, in the early 90s, in 1990, 1991, 92, 93, you have scores of massacres dotted across Kashmir's history. And when you're a young person, when you see that, yes, of course, you understand what's happening, but you don't really process it. It takes years. It takes years to understand what happened.
Were you scared?
I was scared. So many emotions and so many reactions to what happened. In the early 90s, as I said, because there was also a mass uprising, so we, including me, we used to be on the street or at night beating the roof of our house with a stick. Kashmir has sloping tin roofs because of the weather. So that was one of the things Kashmiris used to come out every night singing songs of freedom and asking for azadi, asking for their right to self-determination. And you would beat these roofs. I did it as well. I was a young person. This was before all the massacres started.
So essentially you grew up in a idyllic, beautiful country where you used to swim in lakes and play in streams. And then almost overnight, you were a teenager in the war zone.
Yeah, it was a proper theater of war. It was brutal. Not just me. See, it was almost banal. It was so every day, it was so frequent. All of 90s, there was probably never a day when we did not count our dead. Kashmir has been burning for 30 years. Kashmir's finest literary export, Aga Shahid Ali, the poet. I was a young student in Delhi when I first read Country Without a Post Office, which is his seminal collection of poems. And there is a phrase in it, Kashmir is burning, that occurs in Aga's poems. And it's still burning. And the reason it's burning is Kashmiris have basically been shouting, screaming in all kinds of ways, peaceful ways and also, you know, in the armed way. That can you also ask us when you want to decide our destiny? And that's, you know, if you want to reduce it to broad lines, that's what it is.
Vidhi, what's changed since the 90s?
Since the 90s, there have been periods of calm. There have been moments when people have thought, maybe this will be resolved. And actually, one of those moments was when Modi came to power in 2014. He made these kind of very magnanimous gestures towards Pakistan, which suggested that there might have been conditions to negotiate a peace deal at last over this long disputed territory. And so he, on a trip to Afghanistan, kind of on the way back, he made the surprise stop in Pakistan and went and met Nawaz Sharif and gave him a big hug.
A Kabul stopover and a surprise Lahore detour. By extending an unexpected olive branch to Pakistan, Prime Minister Narendra Modi became the first Prime Minister to visit the neighboring state in 11 years.
If you are generous towards Modi, there is an argument to be made that he tried to make it work.
What happened? If Modi was seeming to be willing to talk, what went wrong?
This could depend on how cynical your view of Modi is. You know, for a lot of people, though, all of these gestures of peacemaking were just politics. But, you know, there's also this huge international context at this present moment that makes this a very politically smart move for Modi. If you step back and think about Trump,
President Trump welcomed India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi to the White House today, and in keeping with the Prime Minister's penchant for hugging, well, there was an abundance. Two bear hugs before cameras in the Rose Garden.
Trump has suggested that he wants to mediate the India-Pakistan-Kashmir conflict, but he's also shown a huge reluctance to intervene in foreign conflicts. And then there's also China, which is engaged in this trade war with America. And then there's also Pakistan, which has suggested, you know, right after the February airstrikes, that it doesn't really want a war with India, that it can't afford one right now.
And are countries reluctant to criticize India because it's such a huge emerging superpower, really, a developing economy that they want to be doing deals with?
Yeah, nobody wants to get on India's bad side right now. It's the kind of country that everybody wants an alliance with. And broadly, India has supported nationalist governments in other countries, and those governments are now willing to support India. So if you look at India's support for Israel, for Trump, and in other places, India has shown itself as a country that's not going to get in the way of other leaders' big agendas.
Is India hoping that by revoking Article 370, it will encourage Hindus from across the country to buy up land in Kashmir?
Definitely. One of the justifications that the Indian government has made for revoking Article 370 is that this provision that protects Kashmiri land rights needs to go if Kashmir wants to develop. But what a lot of Kashmiris fear is that this is going to open up the path for a whole demographic change of Kashmir's religious makeup. So Kashmir at the moment is 68% Muslim, 28% Hindu. If Hindus start buying land, that could completely change.
Is there a kind of reasonable justification for the anger from Indians that they haven't been able to buy land in Kashmir? I mean, there used to be a much larger Hindu population there.
Yeah, absolutely. So the way Indians see it is Kashmiris can come to Delhi, can come to Mumbai, they can come and buy houses anywhere. They have all of the same rights that Indians have. Why should they be protected? Why should Kashmir have this special status?
Why should they?
It's a question of self-governance.
And this is causing massive tension between Pakistan and India. What's happening?
Prime Minister Imran Khan, he's made it very clear that he doesn't want to go to war. In fact, he even got up in Parliament and said, "What do you want me to do? Do you want me to go to war with India?"
This is news coming in from Pakistan, where the Prime Minister over there, Imran Khan, has said that Prime Minister Narendra Modi is and urged him to give peace a chance and assured him.
But he has done everything he can to express his concern about this move. So he has downgraded diplomatic ties. He sent the High Commissioner packing. He has cancelled this train that goes from Delhi to Lahore twice a week. He has put restrictions on trade, and he's banned Bollywood movies.
There's all the cultural stuff, but pretty serious diplomatic ties being broken.
Yeah.
How has India responded to Pakistan on that?
India's External Affairs Ministry has put out a statement saying this is an internal matter. Pakistan should mind its own business.
I.e., Kashmir is part of India, so why are you turning this into anything else?
Exactly.
So India doesn't even acknowledge that Kashmir has different status?
No. And in fact, if you open up your Google Maps in the UK or in America or wherever you're listening, you'll see that Kashmir has a dotted line around it because the world acknowledges it as a disputed territory. But if you open up Google Maps within India, it's a hard line because it is a crime to even acknowledge that there is a dispute that Kashmir does not belong to India.
Pakistan doesn't want war. Mm-hmm. At the moment, we're talking about diplomatic ties being cut. Mm-hmm. Tell me why you think this is so significant, and also what could happen next.
I think if there was any doubt in the minds of Kashmiris about autonomy or the promises that Kashmir had been given when it agreed to be a part of India, I think there is all hope of that is gone now. And a lot of Kashmiris refer to this as an occupation, and now that view will crystallize. But it could also lead to a whole generation of Kashmiri militancy. It could inflame all kinds of internal political tensions within India. The way Modi has presented this to India is, "I'm fixing this long-standing problem." But really, if you look at the history of Kashmir, this isn't the end.
That was Vidhi Doshi, Azhar Farooq and Mirza Wahid. Do follow this unfolding story on our website at theguardian.com. Coming up, Zimbabwe's economy is descending into chaos with terrible consequences. Now, after the military coup that removed Robert Mugabe from power, there was a feeling of optimism in Zimbabwe. More than 18 months later, Africa correspondent Jason Burke looks at a very different reality.
November 2017, you have the end of decades of rule by the increasingly autocratic and idiosyncratic Robert Mugabe. He was removed really by a military coup, but power then reverted to the ruling party, the ZANU-PF. The new president was Emmerson Mnangagwa, who was Mugabe's right-hand man. There were elections in July and August last year, and those elections were, well, at least the campaign was relatively free and fair. Immediately after the elections, there were six people killed by soldiers in the centre of Harare after some protests. And that was really an indication that much of the old way of doing things hadn't changed. It's very difficult to say quite where Zimbabwe is going at the moment, but what is certainly the case is that the optimism, the hope that there was even a year ago, certainly 18 months ago, has now gone. You could blame Mnangagwa in recent months for having failed to push through real serious reforms, particularly in the security sector, to try and get the police and the army and the security services under control. Overall, what is certainly the case is that you have a very large number of hungry people, possibly a third or more of the population at the moment, that are going to need United Nations food aid, among other things. You have limited power, you have soaring prices of staple goods, you have a standoff between the opposition and the government, and overall it's a very complex, very difficult situation and one that could easily lapse into violence. I spoke to people in a poor neighbourhood of Harare called Mbare, and they were just working on each day as it came.
I can't see any change. Like, I can't even promise that things are going to be better, because things are changing day by day, like from bad to worse. It's something that is really giving us less hope that our country is going to change somehow.
The real problem is that the government can do all the financial reforms they want at whatever cost in terms of austerity measures or pain to ordinary people, but they're still not going to get the kind of huge bailout that they need from international lending institutions, because they won't do the political reforms. And this is very clear. Without the political reforms, without more transparency, without more accountability, without moving against senior army officers who are able to order troops to shoot a dozen or so people in one set of repressive violence and half a dozen in another, unless all of that happens, it's politically impossible for the international community to stump up the cash that Zimbabwe needs to refloat its economy and start rebuilding its infrastructure and turning itself back into what it once was, the breadbasket of Africa. And as long as ZANU-PF are in power, it seems very unlikely that they're going to push through reforms that would diminish their own power.
Do read Jason's reporting from Zimbabwe at the website. That's all for today. My thanks to Vidhi Doshi, Azhar Farouk, Mirza Wahid and Jason Burke. This episode was produced by Mithili Rao and Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Eloise Stevens. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.